But it allowed us to really scale. We had, at some point, we had 500,000 monthly visitors, and we were still running a server of $40 a month.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And that is really what got us to be able to scale to many users
I would
with
have
Filter.
Never expected that.
Welcome to the JS World Podcast, powered by passionate people. Here we interview our speakers from the JS World Conference. We talk life, tech, and all sorts of things. Like what we have to offer? Like and subscribe. And don't forget to follow us on at JS World Conf on Twitter.
Hello and welcome back to another interview. Today, well, actually today, we have had many speakers.
Oh, yeah.
And right now, we are sitting in the room with Yves Van Horn. Hello, Yves. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. We've spent the whole day searching for you, and I'm not joking. We've had multiple people running around the theater. Where's Yves? And people said, well, he's over there. No, he's over there.
Oh, no,
I saw him leave. He had to go to the office. He'll be back. I'm sure he'll be back.
Yeah, is he back? No, he's not back.
No, he's not like back. I don't think he's coming back. Yeah, he's coming back. He said he would be back. All in all, we're very happy that you're here because we've really wanted to talk to you.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. Don't be sorry. It's just, it's amazing that you're here. I think that, let's put that first. It's really nice that you're here, willing to talk to us on this podcast / interview. We were not able to see your talk because we've been busy doing podcasts the entire day. But that's, at least not to me. I have a different question. Yves, you're 25 years old. You are the founder of Code Sandbox. What's it like to be 25 years old and run your own company that's used by so many developers? Product, I should say, but...
What's it like? That's an interesting... It's a very good question. So, first of all, if I would look... If I would be in a situation 5 years ago when Code Sandbox just started, and I would say... I would look forward in 5 years and I would see the situation that we would be in right now, I wouldn't be able to believe it, probably. It's really, really crazy how we've grown over time and the different types of situations that we got into. It's our anniversary today, actually. 5 years ago, we released Code Sandbox.
Congratulations. Yeah, happy birthday.
Thank you. But it's interesting because there are a lot of milestones along the way. And every time, every milestone felt like a huge celebration. Like, for example, the first 100 users on Code Sandbox was huge. I think we got champagne for it. And then the first 10,000 users was also huge. And that was already beyond our imagination. Like, we couldn't have imagined that we had 10,000 people using Code Sandbox. And over time, we started to get these new milestones. And they felt all incredibly crazy. But the interesting thing is, then you get used to that situation. So, for example, when we got 10,000 users and you go on for a month, then you think, okay, yeah, we got 10,000 users. That's pretty great. But then you need to take a step back and realize how cool that is to really understand how cool it is. It's pretty hard to, how can I best describe it? To get to the moment you actually get the milestone, hit the milestone, that feels best. And then you get used to it very fast, which is both a good thing and a great thing. Because if my 5 year younger self would be suddenly put in position today where I would have a conference talk in the morning and then suddenly a job interview after and then a performance review after, I think I wouldn't be able to handle it, all the stress that comes with it. But because it has been a gradual change up to that moment, it becomes more handleable, if that would be a word. I remember the first time I went to a conference, I was nervous for a month before the actual talk, which is pretty crazy. And as I've given more talks, now I get nervous, still the same level of nervousness, but I get nervous an hour before the talk, which...
At least you can. Well, at least you can sleep. Yeah. At least you can sleep the day before.
That's
still a lot better. Nice.
That is true.
But that's a powerful way to also look at it. With the, you're basically just always moving the mileposts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first 100, that's a massive thing if you come from zero.
Yeah.
But then from 100 to 1,000, if you would make the step at first immediately to go from zero to 1,000, Do you think that would have changed the way things would have gone? Like, would that goal have seemed too big to actually to reach? Or
yeah, exactly. So when we started, 1,000 people was already outside of our peripheral vision. That was pretty. That would have been pretty crazy. And so it's a kind of a mantra that both my co-founder Bas and I, we'd like to be in an uncomfortable situation as often as possible, because that's when you learn the most. And at some point, the uncomfortable situation becomes comfortable, and you have to find a new uncomfortable situation. And that's kind of like moving those posts, I think. That's the... I wonder... Nah, it's maybe not something to wonder about. But I wonder if we would start over from scratch today, how would it feel to get again those first 100 users? Would it feel the same? Would it feel different? I'm not sure.
Well, maybe it's a question you can answer in a couple of years' time when you start a new project. Who knows? We don't know what it's going to be like. But I can imagine that once your uncomfortable becomes comfortable, at some point, I can imagine you might reach a point where there is no more uncomfortable, because you've gone through all of the uncomfortable situations and you need to, refocus on something else.
That's tricky. Like,
I think you start dreaming bigger as well.
Yeah, maybe that too. Because I'm out of curiosity. Because you've been speaking about these different milestones, and you hit a milestone. You are absolutely flabbergasted that you were able to hit the milestone, and then you get used to it. So what was the last milestone that you hit, and how long did it take for you to get used to it?
Ooh, the last biggest milestone that we hit was, we released something new called CodeSandbox Projects. And CodeSandbox Projects is a rewrite, essentially, of CodeSandbox, but specifically built for full development. So when you start on CodeSandbox, you often start with a prototype. But sometimes that prototype grows bigger, and you want to make it an actual development project with Git repository, and you maybe want to use your own editor. That's why we built CodeSandbox Projects. And we've been wanting to enable this for like the last 3 years, and now we actually released it to the public, and that was a huge milestone. And that happened two weeks ago, and I am still not used to it. So I think it also takes a while to get used to it. And given that, maybe you also get unused to it, because I remember being extremely active on Twitter, for example, and that was when we were working actively on the original version of CodeSandbox. And while we started working on this new version of CodeSandbox Projects, all our attention went to that, so we weren't as active on Twitter anymore about what we were building on CodeSandbox, because we couldn't share yet what we were building on CodeSandbox, because it was a private project back then. Now it's public again, and I'm back on Twitter much more active, and I like it a lot. So it's funny, because I got used to Twitter, then I stopped using Twitter, and now I get back on Twitter and it feels like a new feeling again. I don't know. I'm also thinking, if I would start over, it would kind of be disastrous if I wouldn't see the first 100 users as a milestone. If I would only be satisfied with 1 million registered users, then I would be always dissatisfied with what's happening.
Because that's so far away, right? Like,
right.
If you go from 0 to 1 million, that's such a moonshot. That's almost impossible to imagine.
That's exactly. A lovely way of putting it. That's such a moonshot. Yeah.
But what didn't made you start with like, what was the problem we were trying to solve at the start of CodeSandbox? Because I'm not familiar with CodeSandbox, I must honestly admit. So maybe a small primer on that.
So around 6 years ago, I worked as a web developer at an auction website called GataWiki, and React was just up and coming back then, and I was at some point on vacation to a place called St. Ives, and I got questions from my coworkers about pieces of code, and they sent me snippets on Slack, and I just had to decipher from those snippets what was actually running behind that code. And I couldn't really understand it. So at that moment, I thought it would be very, very interesting if you would be able to have your development environment available everywhere. Like, what if they could just share a link to an actual code editor that runs your code so that I can immediately see what's going on? And that's essentially what became CodeSandbox. CodeSandbox is an online code editor. You can just go to a link and you have an environment running. You have code on the left and you have a preview of that code running on the right. If that code outputs a website, for example. And when you want to create your own creation, you click fork. You get your own URL, your own environment, and you can start writing code. And you can share that link with anyone and they can see actually how it works. So it's kind of like a collaborative development environment. It allows you to really share a development environment with a link instead of asking someone to download your code and run it in their own development environment.
It's a really specific need. It's really cool. But did it also mean that the first 100 users were people that were close to you specifically or to your co-founder, like colleagues that were working with it? Or
no, it's interesting because initially I built this really to make it easier for people to collaborate with each other on codes, like this exact case of code snippets that you had to share, like you had a question. But people found their own use cases for it over time. So for example, people started using it for creating bug reports that they can have reproducibles. People started using it for job interviews. They started using it for workshops, for university courses, documentation, examples, and well, a ton of other use cases.
It's a very flexible tool to use.
Yeah, it's if you think about it, the fact that you can share a running development environment without having to ask the other person to install that development environment is extremely powerful. Like currently, development is not very accessible because if you want to learn how to develop, well, you have to install a development environment. You have to install a code editor, a terminal, a bundler, everything that you really need to execute code. And if you can just open a link and immediately have a running version, that makes it much more accessible. It also makes it possible, for example, for designers to actually see what you're working on. Like, let's say I'm implementing a design from a designer and I want to get some feedback on the animation speed. If I can just share a link with them and they can immediately see what I've built and they can play with it and they can say, oh no, can you make the animation a bit faster, for example? And I immediately make that change and they can immediately see the result. That is a really interesting flow that you can enable.
This is a very powerful addition to your workflow.
Right.
So you started Code Sandbox back in 2016.
Yeah.
How was the landscape back then? Were there any other tools that provided something similar?
Yeah. So I think the closest that you could find was CodePen. And CodePen is an incredible tool. It allows you to see HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And you could write code in those three fields and then you would see an immediate preview of that. And a lot, it was very close to CodeSandbox actually, but then CodeSandbox was built more for JavaScript projects, for React projects, for Vue projects, Angular projects, in the sense that you could, install NPM dependencies, for example. And it looked more like a development environment. And so for these specific use cases, for example, for like React, it was an incredible tool. Besides CodePen, there was not any tool that did it like CodeSandbox. There was Webpack Bin. That's an older project, which is really interesting because Webpack Bin kind of did did the same as CodeSandbox to a big extent, except their approach was different in the sense that they compiled the code on the server using Webpack. And it's funny because the creator of Webpack Bin, Christian, he started to work together with me on building services that we both use. So we started sharing libraries and services between our services. And later on, he joined CodeSandbox. So that's pretty... And he's one of the first joiners. And he's actually on the walk to here. I had a long call with Christian. Like, we are really good friends. So that was a pretty nice collaboration turning out into a good friendship.
That's really cool. That's a nice anecdotal story there. I'm wondering, though, with CodeSandbox, you say, you know, we offer developers the ability to install dependencies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, how you solve that particular part, because immediately I'm thinking of all these different barriers that you'd have to go through to make this happen. Because is it instance based, yes or no? Where are you going to host those instances? How long does it take to spin up an instance? How are you going to do the dependency installation and then feed that back into your graphical interface? How are you going to manage that? What's going to be the lifetime? Like, all these questions spring into mind. Like,
so much storage.
I mean, node modules can easily run up to like hundreds of megabytes as well, right? And the installation process takes a fair amount of time. And because it's, I'm assuming it's instance-based, right? So how did you solve that? How did you create something that scales from a single user to 100, to tens of thousands of users, to millions of users?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. So when we started CodeSandbox, we were students and we had $300 a month to live on total. And so we couldn't afford really to have servers. So the approach that we took, because CodeSandbox was really built for these small projects and prototypes, like the use case that I initially mentioned in when I was on vacation, we started looking into running everything in the browser. And that's also the approach that we took. We run everything in the browser, meaning that if you install a dependency, okay, we don't run everything in the browser. Now I'm saying the wrong thing. When you install a dependency, we have a serverless function that will package that dependency. It will do a yarn install for that dependency, and then it will pick out the files that you will likely need in your project. So it will go through the dependency graph of all the dependencies that it needs. It will say, oh, this file is probably needed because that's the index file, and then this file requires these other files, so we probably need those. And it generates one kind of big JSON bundle out of this. And that JSON bundle is put in S3 behind the CDN. And in the browser, we download that bundle. So it's all statically hosted. And then we execute that code in the browser. And if there are any files that are missing from that bundle, we fetch them independently from a service like Unpackage or JS Deliver, which are CDNs behind NPM.
Okay.
And in case it's not on there, we download the tar file and we unpack that in the browser and we read from there. That's the more of a crazy approach. But it allowed us to really scale. At some point, we had 500,000 monthly visitors and we were still running a server of $40 a month.
Oh, wow.
And wow.
That is really what got us to be able to scale to many users.
I would have never expected that. Like with all these files, there's so much storage. So you would expect it to take so much space as well. But filtering out these files that you don't need, that's really smart because you don't need to read me of everything.
Yep, exactly. You don't need the typings. You don't need the... And yeah, there's also so many, like, for example, for an icon library, that was also a really tricky case because with an icon library, you have tons of icons in all one single. SVGs. Yeah. And so we didn't include anything there because often you need a single icon from an icon library. So
you just download that after the fact from Unpackage.
Yeah. Like such a CDN. And CDNs are quite cheap. Like Cloudflare is free. So you can put Cloudflare in front of your S3 buckets and you can put the caching on infinite. And then it wouldn't even hit your S3
because it's a single asset anyway, and you have the version specific anyway. So once put on S3, it can stay there forever because it's a single version.
Yeah, and our S3 bucket is now over multiple terabytes just of node modules.
But then again, multiple terabytes for how many users you have, that's still not
it's cheap.
Much.
I mean, it's S3, store, so it's super cheap.
Yeah, go to the store. You can buy an 8-terabyte drive for maybe 200 euros. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
It is incredibly efficient, actually, if you think about it.
Because I was thinking more like the connection between the client and the server in this case, but there is no connection because you're making full use of the cloud here in a very smart way. I never thought of this being an actual option. This is a very interesting way of looking at this.
If you don't have a lot of money, you have to find ways, right?
You have to be creative.
Well, I mean, I think that is also the case, right? Because if you have the money, then at least... If I'm looking at myself and thinking from my own sort of purview, I would go for the known solutions, right? Oh, we could do this because it's cheap anyway, and we have the budget to do it this way, so let's do it this way.
Yeah.
So when you hit the milestone of 100 users, what were the costs of CodeSandbox at the time? Do you remember?
Also $40. So interesting thing is that we had a VPS. Of at Falter, I think, of $40, and it hosted the database, it hosted the Elixir server. We did have an API server behind it, and that was it.
So it's a single server, and that's it?
Yeah, a single VPS of $40, that's what we started out with, and that's what we used for the first 2 years until we moved to Kubernetes.
That's crazy. I'm amazed by this. So you were able to serve 500,000 monthly users, which is very, very respectable on a $40 VPS.
Yeah.
Running Code Sandbox.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Interesting, right?
How big was Code Sandbox yeah. at the time? How many people were there?
Boss and me. It was the two of us. We were just still the students that were going to the student parties and the beer ponging, and then in the free time we were working on Code Sandbox, which was a very fun time.
it sounds like, how has the change been for you moving from being a student to being the CEO of a company that has an American investor?
Yeah, it was a hard change. It was a frictionful change. My friends at university, they called me a student, a non-student that was still very much trying to be a student. I was in hindsight, I think that I dropped out from university a bit too early because I was not ready to let go of the freedom of a student life the moment we started hiring people. But then you become responsible for people, right? And you need to make sure that they are coached in a good way, that they feel like they are doing their best work, that they are actually doing their best work. And I was not ready for that challenge at the start. When we just got funding, we immediately grew the team to 8 people. And you could just see that at the start, when we started, you could see our development grinding to a halt because we didn't have great onboarding. We didn't know much about culture, how to set up a right culture. We didn't really have values, let alone a roadmap, because Buzz and I would just think of a roadmap on the spot. Like, what are we going to build next week? What are we going to build in 2 weeks? Let's iterate and prototype it. So there were a ton of learnings at the start. I think we're in a much better position now with Code Sandbox. We're now 29 people, and it's been so much. A year ago, we were 12 people, and so we've grown with like 17 people in the last year. But that has been handled so much better than the first 8 people, and we still do have growth pains. That's, I think, it's something that always happens, but we're much more mindful of them. Like, it's something that we really see for the challenge that it is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, that makes perfect sense.
How does your responsibilities kind of shift in the scaling up of Code Sandbox? Because I can imagine that if you are starting to hire people, like going from 2 to 8 is already a massive difference, because you were just the two of you making things up on the fly, and suddenly you have 6 more people that you're responsible for.
Yeah.
So that's going to shift your responsibility from just making the product to also managing the people. So how did that actually change your responsibilities inside the company? And were you still able to actually work on the technology, or are you finding yourself to be more of an HR manager these days?
Tricky. So I had a lot of trouble with that. I found out that I get a lot of energy from building products. I get a lot of energy from finding solutions to hard problems and showing them to people. And the first thing that you have to do when you start managing people is internalize and realize that your output is the output of the people you manage. Like, if they do great, you do great. And I remember struggling with that, not getting a lot of energy. But how the responsibilities changed over time is that between Buzz and me, we found better responsibilities between the kind of work that he does and the kind of work that I do. Whereas I am very unstructured, I'm very chaotic, and I can sometimes, when I see a problem to be solved, I can get very deep into that problem and try to solve it. Buzz is much more structured. He can set up an org chart. He knows how to set goals for different teams. He knows how to make sure that those goals are met. So when we found that out, when we found out how our responsibilities and how strengths and weaknesses match up to each other, we created an environment where Buzz is mostly doing everything that's structured, and I am very focused on products and on coaching people build products. But even then, I sometimes still code from time to time. Like, I see something that could be coded, and then I ask an engineer if they want to pair program with me on it, and then we build something together. So when Code Sandbox started, I was really heavy on products. Then Code Sandbox, we got new people on board, and I was going much more into a manager style. Then I realized that this is not my strength, really. And then Bas and I, then I became more again on product, but not as deep in product anymore as I used to be. Now I rather coach people and help help product find a good direction and work with them together.
So you say I help find products, find the right direction. How does that look like on a day-to-day basis?
So we have milestones for Code Sandbox. And so, for example, we just released Code Sandbox projects, and then we have certain milestones that we want to hit to get to the new phase. Right now, we have released Code Sandbox projects for a waitlist, with a waitlist, and we've set the goal for the whole team to get to those, to certain milestones. And when we've hit those milestones, we're ready to make it open beta, and then more people can use it. And how we set it up is that I write down what I think the biggest product focuses should be to get to those milestones as fast as possible. And then I share that with the team, and the team gives feedback. We talk about this, talk about the product focuses, whether it's the right approach. And if we agree that this is the right approach, then we start working on these product focuses with different teams. And I try to make sure that when I write down those product focuses, I don't say how it should be done. I'd rather say what the desired effect is. So, for example, one of those product focuses is that we really want to improve the review flow, that if someone has built a feature, that we make it really easy for people to review it or even suggest changes. But then it's important to not say what should be done, because then you don't give the freedom to the team to actually think for themselves what the best solution is. And there will be less ownership. And you didn't hire people just to build what you think should be built. You hire people because you want them to really think deeply about the problem and think of solutions themselves. So to the extent that I'm still involved with product, that's generally how I'm thinking about it.
That must have been a learning curve as well, though. Like, I can imagine that you would think at the start that you would still be involved a bit more, and that instead of giving them a result to aim for, you would still get too involved in how it should be done, because of course it was your product with Bus, and you're like maybe wanting to have it in a specific certain way, and then you bring in six more people and now you're 29.
Yeah.
So right now I'm sure, like how I hear it, you clarified that kind of split between or like the limits that you don't say how people should do it. But I think in the start,
yeah,
it would have been very normal.
Difficult
to still
to let
do
go.
That. Yeah, to let go and then still try to guide them a bit more in the how they should be doing it instead of giving them a result. Was that like a learning curve that you had to go through, or
did it come
naturally?
No. It almost feels like I feel like I'm really bad at building a company, because it feels like I'm making mistakes every day. And this is one of those mistakes that I've made. Like at the start of the company, it still works out. Like you can say, we are going to build this. And because the team is small, you build it together with the team. You're kind of like one of those. You're part of the team in the sense that you are part of the team that looks for a solution. But then the team grew and grew and grew. And at some point you just cannot say anymore what should be done, because there are just too many projects. You become the bottleneck on most of the projects. And at the same time, it's a huge letdown for a lot of people who join the company if they don't have ownership or if they cannot say how a problem should be solved. Like if I would join a company and I would see a great solution to a problem that's been written down, but I don't have any way to suggest that solution and start working on that solution, that would be incredibly frustrating. I've learned this the hard way, like most things in the last few years. I definitely would have done things very differently from the start if I would start a new company. I've learned a ton, and I am still making mistakes every day, which is both a good thing because it's a learning experience, also a bad thing because it means that you are putting yourself in a situation where you don't move as fast as you had hoped, or you're putting yourself even worse in a situation where other people are affected in an unintended way, where the situation's just not fair for them because you've handled it wrong from the start.
Yeah, I can. Well, I want to say I can imagine that. I've never been in a position like that where I'm responsible for multiple people, and your decisions, your choices, whether they be right or wrong, have such an impact on people. But it must be very difficult for you sometimes. The way that you're speaking about this as well, I can tell sort of that this is not an easy road to walk, being the executive of a company that now employs 29 people.
Yeah.
And having a product that is used and loved by so many developers. On the other hand, though, I mean, Code Sandbox is, you see it popping up a lot more and a lot more. And I have the idea that it's becoming more and more a staple of the developer toolset. So, I mean, on the other hand, there's this great tool that you've been able to put out with your team, with your company. And I think that deserves recognition as well in that sense, right? Even though the road that you have walked has not been an easy one, it has resulted in something that's been great for people to use. And you've been iterating on this in ways that make it even more usable, more pleasant for people to use with new features,
yeah,
such as Code Sandbox projects. I did not know that you were working on this. I did not know it was released, but it sounds like it's something that's worth a try, because it adds to your ability as a developer to make it more accessible.
Yeah. You're completely right. Like at the start, the mantra of it's better to be in an uncomfortable situation, right? And this is kind of like the embodiment of that. Like, you learn the most in an uncomfortable situation. And it's completely true. It's very easy to look at the things that can go wrong or have gone wrong. But there has been so many good things from this. For CodeSandbox Projects is an example of that, right? We have been trying to build CodeSandbox in such a way that you can use it for all your development for the last 3 years. And now a year ago, we sat down and we said, okay, we cannot build it into the existing CodeSandbox. It's just technically a big challenge. And we started building CodeSandbox Projects. But it's crazy that a year ago, we were just talking about building CodeSandbox Projects. And now we have CodeSandbox Projects that we at CodeSandbox used for the past like 5 months to develop CodeSandbox ourselves. So it's pretty crazy. And in the same time, grew the team from 12 to 29 people.
That's insane.
There is a lot to be said about the good things too. And I tend to sometimes get a bit negative on the... but at the same time, it's good to recognize everything that can be improved.
Exactly. I mean, who here can say at 25, I have a company that employs 29 people. I have a product that's being used by I don't know how many developers. I have another project which allows people to fully switch their environment, their development environment, to an online environment that we provide, that we have actively been using to develop said online environment. Which that's crazy. That sounds crazy to me.
It's very specific, though, I think.
I mean, like, there are not many products out there that will be able to do this in a year's time, let alone in an eat your own dog food style. And then also grow their company from 12 people to 29 people. So again, I want to just point out here that that's an amazing feat, and you should be very proud of that. I mean, that's the stuff of legends, I'd say. It's crazy.
It can only be enabled with the right people in that perspective. Like, we've hired some really, really talented people who's been through startups multiple times, and who already, for example, saw the value of great onboarding. And so to that extent, I mainly learned about how good onboarding can be due to the fact that the people on our team have set up a great onboarding flow. So most credit goes to the team. And it's really, really, the team that we have at CodeSandbox is incredible. The things that we build, if you go through our Slack, we have an ideas channel. The ideas that come up there are absolutely, sometimes they're completely crazy, but there are also so many gems in there of things that we really should build, and things that I think only a place like CodeSandbox, such ideas can come up. So
such a free flow of ideas sounds really cool. Is that also something that you try to promote with your culture inside of the company?
Yeah. For us, what CodeSandbox is mostly about is that we build things for creators, and we want to make it easier for creators to build things. So there are two sides to that. Whenever someone has an idea, it should be really easy for them to build that idea and play with it and show it to other people, or even invite other people to work on that idea. But even if you have an idea, for example, for an application, let's say a grocery list application or something, and you don't know how to code, we want to make that much easier as well. That even if you don't know how you should build an application, that we really lower the learning curve of getting introduced to development.
I think I can, I almost want to say you should talk to Maggie about this, because she has some very, very good ideas how to make things more accessible and as she called it, democratizing programming.
Yeah.
By way of, for example, visuals.
Yeah.
That could be a match made in heaven for you guys.
Yeah, we've talked quite a bit. I think I'm a huge fan of her. It's like the talk that she gave, it hits the nail on the head. People are visual species. So everything that you can do to visualize codes is extremely powerful. Like if you show two numbers, for example, a small number and a big number, it will take longer for your brain to process what is bigger compared to if you show like a small circle and a big circle. So everything that we can do to make coding more accessible is extremely valuable. And for CodeStemBox, that's exactly what we want to do. Our kind of sort of strategy right now is that we want to make CodeStemBox projects really great for developers, so that developers want to introduce CodeStemBox to their teams. But our next step is that we want to build accessible tooling so that not only developers can use it, but for example, if a designer sees that the margin is not right, that we give them visual tooling that they can actually change that margin. Or if a designer wants to leave a quick review on an animation, that they can actually leave a comment on the preview and that we link that to code for the developer again. So that not only developers use an online development environment, but designers, marketing, product management can use it too.
I really love that. Yes. It's a topic we've seen throughout the day where it's democratizing
programming making, it's more accessible.
Using it more. It's like we are seeing a big shift in, instead of programming being just almost like mathematically based for just the mathematical inclined people, that it's starting to become more of a creative profession where we also want to be right. other people to be involved instead of just the programmers that like to work with numbers.
Yeah.
So I think that shift, this is a really interesting topic.
There's also a huge opportunity right now because the way that design tools and development tools have evolved is in a very similar fashion, which is super interesting. Like when you design something, you often create variants, and those variants, you can change props on those variants. And so that you can have different variations of the actual, like you say, you have a primary button, secondary button, and you have a switch that you can switch between the two. In development, it's exactly the same. Like React is working with components, and those components, they accept props. And so, for example, you can have a button component that is primary or secondary. So you can see the match. Designers think the same way as developers, except developers implement it in code, whereas designers implement it in a design tool. So how can you make it possible that a designer, when they see a button, that they can click on that button and they can actually change the props in a visual way, like they would do in a design tool? And then they can open a pull request. And we make all of that very easy because we know the Git commands to run. We know the project itself. We know the type definitions of all the props. We know everything really about your project to accommodate such a workflow.
I'm looking to the side here because I'm imagining how this is going to look like in a couple of years and how this would work on a technical level. And I think CodeSandbox has a pretty, pretty great future ahead of it.
Oh yeah,
listening definitely. To these ideas.
It's funny because 2 years ago we created prototypes of this, of how this could work, and it worked really well. But then we realized CodeSandbox is only used for prototyping and small projects. So if we would enable it just for that, then we would enable it only for prototyping. And that's when we started to actively think about, okay, how can we enable CodeSandbox for full development? Because we'd like to bring these tools to the actual development environment, to the full development environment where actually code gets shipped in the end. And it feels like now we've hit a huge milestone with CodeSandbox where we have created the foundation where you can do full development on CodeSandbox. And now it's the next step would be to introduce this tooling to that environment. So
awesome. I'm looking forward to the future of CodeSandbox. Exactly. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been Yves Van Horn. thank you so much.
Thank you
very much. And I really enjoy talking to you and listening about
Code Sandbox. Thanks for taking us on your journey.
Yeah,
from 2 to 29.
It's and then at 25, like this has been a running topic for us throughout the day, where we said like, I feel old now. I feel old. Like, what have I done with my life?
Yeah, we got some catching up to do.
Right? Yeah, well, actually, you know, do, are you still hiring?
We
asking for a friend.
We are.
Well, okay. So Code Sandbox is still hiring. So if people would like to join, where would they have to go?
CodeSandbox.io/jobs. And if you don't see a job description that matches what you're looking for, you should still send an email at careers@codesandbox.io. So
super nice. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and until the next one.